At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here tonight, Justin Townsend, and we've got a very special guest with us. I'm preparing myself for some sharp conversation, I'll say. Not to be quirky, but I think it'll be great. I'll introduce you to our guest here in just a moment. I'm going to go through kind of our little intro and give you some news since my last podcast with you. So looking back now as we look into the iteration of the world of podcasts, I spent some time out with Colin mule deer hunting here in Eastern Colorado, and had a really great weekend doing it. Learned a lot about Eastern Colorado in the few days that we were out back and forth hunting there. Did some goose hunting, did all kinds of crazy stuff. Found a nice little honey hole, which I'm really excited about, and excited to go revisit here later in the year in December, and then also potentially have next year for some antelope and some mule deer. So super stoked about that. We're going to be putting out an episode. It'll actually come out after this episode, so make a mental note that if you want to learn about our experiences mule deer hunting in Eastern Colorado, then really a cool episode. It was Colin's first not first big game hunt, but first true like big game experience. So if you've seen our social media, then you'll know for a fact that Colin did shoot his first deer, which was really awesome because I got to be there for the moment, but we had a really great time processing it in the field and getting it back here and packaging it and butchering and all that other stuff. Like, just a really, really great time. But outside of that, as many of you know by this time, we have joined the Waypoint Podcast Network. So we're part of a very good collective of like-minded individuals who are sharing great outdoor adventures, be it fishing, be it hunting, be it foraging, or like us, where we're combining it all together and getting in the kitchen. So make sure you're checking that out. You can check them out on their website, Waypoint TV. You can check out the app, Waypoint TV app, I think it is. You can find our podcast in both places. And then, of course, we're always still in the same places you find us regularly. But outside of that, be sure to check out our Facebook community page. I haven't plugged it in a while, but it's a great place to just go and really interact with us on a day-to-day basis. All the field staff writers there, all the managing staff, I'm on there. I see posts daily. I comment, we chat. People post questions, they share what they're doing in the outdoors. It's just a really, really fun spot just to get together and talk. Outside of that, I would say we're still doing hats for reviews. So if you have a great review of the podcast, a written review, punch the 5-star button and then write us a cool written review, and we'll read it on the air. And then as soon as we do that, we'll give you a shout out, email us back, and we'll send you whatever hat you like off our website. So great way to get a free hat and help us out so we can bump our placement up there in Apple Podcasts. So, But with all that said, I think I'll go ahead and introduce our guest today. So he has spent many years working in commercial kitchens, which helped grow his passion for fine food and cutlery. He used this passion and knowledge to create New West Knife Works in Jackson, Wyoming. New West Knives has been featured in Forbes, Outside, Bon Appetit, and many other national publications. He's also a hunter, angler, and conservationist, which we're going to get into, where he's involved as a founder or board member of several different conservation organizations in the Jackson, Wyoming area. Corey Milligan, welcome to the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Howdy, Justin. It's sure a pleasure to be here. This is my first podcast, so I'm very excited. And
it's fun.
And
it's fun.
I can't wait to spend an hour talking about my three favorite things, food, knives, and myself. So it should be fantastic.
That's awesome. Well, I'm excited to learn about it. So you said you were on the road. Where are you at today?
I'm in Park City, Utah. I live in Jackson Hole, but we have a store down here in Park City. And I'm down here visiting the store. And for some reason, I'm on the local daytime TV show showing how to carve a turkey, which I'm currently cooking in this condo that I rented here. And there, it's fraught with possible points of disaster along the way. But
oh, we'll no. It was always tense moments. Always tense moments. it's funny. I'll be in Park City, Utah over Thanksgiving.
Well, nice. So, you'll have to stop by the shop right on Main Street.
Yeah. I will for sure. I'll make it a point. So tell us a little bit more about yourself, where you're from, how you got introduced in the outdoors.
I have lived in Jackson Hole for 30 years. I grew up in the Midwest in Ohio. I think followed the John Denver Rocky Mountain High song as soon as I finished college. And I actually moved to Jackson Hole. I didn't really know much about the West, and I had a geology and a geography professor from college who said that the Tetons, Jackson Hole, was the most beautiful place in America. So I was like, "Well, that sounds good. I'll go with that."
Yeah, and you know, I've been a lot of places in America, and I'm not going to argue with him when he says that. Like, there's a lot of beautiful places out there, but the Tetons are really beautiful.
Yeah, I feel blessed to have lived here this long.
Nice. So, where did your introduction to the outdoors come from? Your hunting, fishing passion.
Growing up, we had 30 acres and some woods, and I feel like I spent most of my youth running around in the woods. Grew up, Ohio style fishing. Started with a bobber, and then a lot of MEP spinners and Rapalas for bass and bluegill. Did some. Some family fishing trips growing up, hunted a bit in high school, didn't grow up in a family of hunters, and then really started hunting when I moved to Wyoming, because how could you not?
Yeah, I agree.
But I have to say, I listened to some of your podcasts today when I was driving, and I was listening to your most recent one about hunting in Wyoming, and I need to really confess that, I'm mostly a foodie meat hunter. Most of my boys, like when they hear me on this thing, they'll be like, you are, they are great lords of huntdom. And they're like, you are no big deal. And I was thinking of your stories of hunting, and mine usually end up being, well, I got out of the truck and leaned the rifle on the hood and... if I can do that, that's usually my that's my preferred option. I like to get the meat down and then start playing with my food.
I'm the same way. If you recount like our, I don't know if it's record setting, but for us, for my little group, it was record setting of like 7 hours of collective antelope hunting, and we're like our three tags and we're done. Like we're moving on to other things. So that's kind of I think at least with antelope, I like the pursuit and I like the stalks, but I also have grown to know that they can be really quickly if you position yourself right. So I tend to favor that more as like a freezer filler trip.
Yeah. It's funny. I listened to your story, and I'm actually headed with my boys out to, what the real Wyoming is, folks would call it, as opposed to Jackson Hole. And I mean, it's to hunt the whitetails, and it's just the most fun, driving around in a truck all day and then drinking whiskey in the cowboy bar at night is just as fun as it gets.
Absolutely, man. I tell you, I mentioned on there, but it's crazy the way that the whitetail population has kind of exploded in Wyoming, and just like, Wyoming Fish and Game is not favorable of their existence the way they're throwing tags out.
Yeah, for sure. And I hate to, well, it's a hunting show, so people won't be upset by it, but I am a Bambi when it comes to that too. Like, little baby whitetails are the greatest, most tender, wonderful wild game. Maybe I have one other preference, but they are just fantastic.
I mean, it's definitely on par. People, when you think about it, I'm like, it's like veal, Yeah. Colin was fortunate enough, even with mule deer, Colin was fortunate enough this past weekend to get a mule deer here in Colorado. And I was like, it was a little button buck. And I was like, dude, that meat is going to be so tender. I was like, it's going to be amazing. You're going to love it. Like, he didn't shoot it intentionally. Like, it just happened to be that was the antlerless tag. I mean, we were walking around with an antlerless tag, and it fell into it. So that's the way it is. But still, a great, great source of meat. Any pride is in your harvest is good. So, so do you think now, since you've been out in Wyoming for several years, do you hunt or fish more, or is there a balance?
I would say I fish for fun, and so fish much more, and hunt for meat, and walking in the woods with a gun. So time wise I definitely have and do fish quite a bit more than hunting.
Nice. Which one's your favorite, do you lean towards?
You mean in terms of fish?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, you mean
Over hunting or fishing, which one do you favor? Do you get like
fishing
really excited?
For sure. For me,
yeah,
I'm kind of like a river guy, so yeah, I it's an excuse to get out on a boat, and so yeah, I really like the fishing.
That's awesome. I don't think I've been. I got family up by Cody, Wyoming, and then I've been a lot on the eastern side of Wyoming, but I don't think I've been to Jackson Hole. Is it? A lot of folks doing fly fishing, river wading, drift boats.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the main kind of sport fishing is, we have a very strong native cutthroat trout species, and they dominate. You could maybe you'd catch a brown trout once in a while. And so it's like, it's a great natural fishery, wild and scenic. Mm-hmm. And so from like an outfitting, just what most people do is that whether it's from shore or in a drift boat and mostly fly fishing. Though there is great, like in Jackson Lake, the big lakes in the park, there's also lake trout fishing, which I don't really do that much, but I have a lot of buddies that do, and particularly like my real cowboy buddies that have grown up there, like they catch monsters in the wintertime ice fishing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've heard there's ice fishing is the way to go if you want to catch big, big lake trout, from what I hear.
Yeah.
So I'm still, I've spent the majority of my life in the southern part of the United States, so this whole concept of ice fishing is still very, very foreign to me. But I was walking around Bass Pro Shop this past weekend, and I was looking at all the ice fishing tents, and I was like, I got to do this. Like, I'm in Colorado. It gets cold enough here to ice fish. Like, people do it. So it's on the, I don't want to say bucket list, because I don't want to call an end to everything, but it's on the list of things to do for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, most places, I think it's a pretty heavy drinking sport.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's everything in Jackson Hole is kind of like taken to the extreme. So the boys are like, beeling out snowmobiling out, you know, a long way and finding the sweet spot. And I'm sure there's some beers drank while they're doing it, but it's not the, you know, I think like Minnesota style, you got a permanent shed that built. You got your whole deal going.
I think about, there's like a Anthony Bourdain episode where he's up in Canada somewhere. And this is obviously several way back, probably 6-7 years ago. And he's fishing with these two guys who own a very respectable and classy restaurant there in the Providence in Canada they're at. And these guys have like a full on kitchen set up in their thing, and they're making like hot cuisine like inside their fishing shack as they're ice fishing, and I just thought that was incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
But so what, you know, you talked about some of your future plans here. What's probably one of your favorite hunting or fishing moments?
Well, you know, when it comes to fishing, my real like niche and what I really enjoy is I actually, before I was really into fly fishing, I was a whitewater rafting guide,
yeah,
whitewater kayaker, and just into the whitewater. And I kind of came at the fishing, you know, it's another one of those things, like all my buddies were, like, you know, fishing guides or just like super into it and still are. And so, you know, I learned to fly fish really quickly at kind of a high level because these guys are, it's either their profession or just their total life passion. And I came at it where I was like, well, I really just like to be in a boat. And, you know, this seems like the fun thing to do. And because I'm a whitewater guy, like I'm super comfortable in any kind of water. And I've always used this. It's a raft. It's called an Air Puma, but it's like it's a skinny pointy raft. And it, you know, it kind of looks like a dory shape, but it's inflatable. And I quickly figured out that, you know, I'd go with my boys in their real dories and we'd do the classic sections of the snake. And there's people all over the place, you know, there's all these other boats, all these people fishing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's not that great. And so I was like, well, if I use my boat that draws no water, and if it hits rocks, you just drag it over, I can fish these rivers where other people don't fish. And so, you know, in Jackson, even today, like if I go, I'm usually taking my raft and going, you know, I like to call them my private waters, where it's either white water and people are either intimidated by it or you just wouldn't want to take a regular hide-sided drift boat down it, or the little tributaries of the snake that, again, are too shallow or rocky for a drift boat. And so that's like that's what I love the most. And, you know, like if I can be casting in a class 3 whitewater stretch, you know, it's like the best thing ever. It's super fun.
So how many fish live in that? I don't know. I'm not much of a,
say that again.
I'm not much of a river angler. How many fish do you find in like the whitewater rapids if you're out there in that?
Well, you definitely can, you know, when you're talking about fly fishing, what's really engaging about fly fishing is it's like target fishing. Mm-hmm. You know, on a river, it's not like, you know, if you're on a tiny stream with a fly, when you're fly fishing and you're, you know, sneaking up the bank and waiting and seeing what the fish is eating. And, you know, and it's this very slow, methodical process, you know, going on a river, and especially our rivers that are pretty fast moving, you're just like, you know, you're just shotgunning the fly into every little eddy, you know, eddy is the spot where the water's slow and moving slowly. You know, you're just firing in as you're going by. So it's super active. And, you know, when you drop, you know, you're in the super fast water, but you drop a fly into this, you know, slow pocket right in the middle of the whitewater, and a fish just comes up and takes the fly. It's just awesome. Super fun.
It is awesome.
And, you know, for that reason, I'm like, it's embarrassing. Like, I have fished a ton, you know, in that style. But, like, when it comes to putting the little 16, 18 size little tiny fly on and dropping it perfectly in with a perfect mend in the little stream. Like, I'm terrible. I like the big, giant grasshopper, Turk's tarantula that it can be sinking or swimming. It doesn't matter if you drag it a little bit. It just makes it sexier to the plot, to the fish. So, I can't really call myself a great angler. I just,
Whatever's fun. I hope you're enjoying the conversation with Corey, the founder over at New West Knife Works. I wanted to pass on this hot deal to you all right here in the middle of the episode. So New West Knife Works, as you're listening, you'll find out, is a company that really believes that cooking's an art and that a quality knife is the artist's brush. So all of their knives are sourced here in the USA and are expertly handcrafted by metalsmiths and artisans in the Tetons. So they're doing us a solid. They're extending a holiday discount exclusively for our podcast listeners. So in order to capitalize on this, you need to go to their website, newwestknifeworks.com, and use code HARVEST15. That's HARVEST15. You have to do this before December 31st, and you'll get 15% off all of their G-Fusion and Ironwood tools for the kitchen and their G-Fusion and Ironwood knives for outdoor adventures. So that's both their kitchen knives and their hunting knives in both the G-Fusion and Ironwood series. So once again, go visit their website, newwestknifeworks.com, and browse their vast inventory and take opportunity of this awesome deal. I guess let's get a little bit into New West Knife Works and kind of go down that story of how it came to be. How did it, the great knife company that I know today, because I use their knives, and I want to talk about it in a little bit, but I use them on my antelope hunt, and I was absolutely, I loved it. But how did it all come to be?
So New West Knife Works, really, and actually, we really have two brands. There's New West Knife Works, which is our really primarily our kitchen knife business. But it's also our main brand name, so we put that on the hunting knives. But in our stores and on our website, we also have this thing called the Mountain Man Toy Shop, which is like, the man cave version of knives, where we've got, the hunting knives, the big-ass custom Bowie knives, and we make tomahawks and throw them in the store, and, everything to do with that. It's the fun. We do old-timey fur and stuff like that, and then a lot of like modern accessory mountain man stuff too. But anyway, New West Knife Works, I started originally, it's going to be 25 years next year, making kitchen knives. I was living in Jackson, in the winter, I was a raft guy, whitewater rafting guy in the summer. In the winter, I was cooking at night so I could go skiing, snowboarding in the daytime. Always had a passion for cooking. But, ski bum, that's what we call it. That's what I was. I knew I wanted to start a business, be in business, and I didn't want to compete with the other people in Jackson. And, the three businesses then and today are tourism, construction, and real estate. Like, that's it. I mean, other things happen, but, those are the primary industries. And I'm like, I want to do something else. I was working in the kitchen. I started messing around with making knives, did some art shows locally, and, people bought them. And so I made more. And I mean, the short of the long is 25 years later, they're still buying them, and I'm still making more of them. But it really came out of this kitchen knife thing. And I found my niche really was making these kind of always high performance was always a priority, but also this kind of artful presentation. And I did fine art shows all over the country for years. Maybe it's probably been 10, 12 years ago, opened a store in Jackson with kitchen knives. It was great business, but everybody came in and said, "Oh, your knives are great. What about hunting knives and other knives? Do you make those?" And I was like, well, I certainly could. I mean, I hunt and I fish and I play in the outdoors. So I could. And so randomly a space came available next door and we're like, well, let's do that. And so came up with this idea for the Mountain Man toy shop. Again, it was, you know, focused on, we called them guy knives. It's incredibly sexist. The number of lady hunters these days is remarkable and they're awesome. But kind of organically just opened that up and, you know, made it a little bit, it's kind of a little bit sexy as far as those things go too. But so now 10 years later, kitchen knives are still our main thing, but we're, you know, we have a great time with and have been very successful with making hunting knives. We have a new pocket knife in the last few years that I think is really great, tomahawks. And then we sell other guys' custom knives. We have a custom forge.
Was it the restored vintage cleavers? They're so cool.
Yeah, they are cool. They are really cool. Yeah, and we sell those as fast as
I see. Yeah, really. And I mean it's just like those are those one of a kind things. Like you come across in like an antique store, and you're like, "Holy smokes, this is awesome." I'm looking at one. What is this? The Nichols Brother Heart and Arrow 10 inch, or the Chester Hog Splitter? Like, come on.
Oh yeah, the hog splitters are unbelievable. And it's what's so cool is like back in the day, somebody had the hand skill to split a hog.
Which is crazy.
Unbelievable.
Because like I don't know if you've ever heard of, he's a chef out of Austin, Jesse Griffiths, but he's got like a cleaver technique where you take the cleaver and you put it on, you know, whatever you're going to do. Say you're going to split ribs off the spine of a deer, and then you use a rubber mallet and you tap it down, and that's kind of like your force.
Yep.
But I think back in the day, like people weren't using mallets. They were just like chopping at it all the way down, and it's pretty phenomenal.
Right. Yeah. You know, I've got a, you heard it here first, folks. This is the introduction. We have a new product in development right now. That is so cool. It's actually a product that we tried to develop, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It's called a cleaver hawk. It's a tomahawk with a cleaver head on. So it has a long wooden handle like a tomahawk, and like I said, we make tomahawks. We're kind of big in tomahawks. But the shape of the blade is like a 6-inch cleaver, and we made some prototypes maybe 5 years ago, and it was super challenging. We were trying to forge it. It required like machining, water jetting the eye, and then forging the blade. It wasn't happening from any kind of a production standpoint. So we just shelved it. And literally 2 weeks ago, I was butchering a pig. I have a prototype. And I was butchering a pig with it. And I'm like, this is so great. And it has a flat back. So you can do that rubber mallet. I think batoning is another term they use for that. But you can hold it there and hit it with a hammer and do that technique you were talking about. But it's got a flat back, it's got a flat face that works really good for that. And so, I mean, this is random knife stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're here for, right? We shelved it because we just couldn't forge it. And then I just, the other 2 weeks ago, I was like, I want this so bad. And then all of a sudden I started thinking like, you know, we make these tomahawks we make are cast. So that's when you pour molten metal into a mold as opposed to, you know, hammer the steel at a lower temperature to shape. Now, traditionally, forging makes a tougher, sharper edged blade. But with our tomahawks, what we did is we used this special steel called S7, which is a impact steel. So like it's used to make like heads for jackhammers and stuff like that. So incredibly tough. And so we've been making our tomahawks, casting our tomahawks out of this for like 5 years, and we never get them back broken. Like they don't break. And they get plenty sharp for an axe or tomahawk head, which is also plenty sharp for a cleaver head. Like, I wouldn't use this to make, you know, a paper slicing, wicked sharp thing, because toughness.
Sure,
is
and with the really with a cleaver or a tomahawk, you're not slicing. You're like, you're chopping or picking at it or batoning. Yeah.
Right. This isn't an Asian style slicing knife. This is a meat cleaver. So I don't, again, you know, who knows why I wasn't smarter about it sooner, but we needed to test it with the tomahawk. Anyway, so got a drawing. We actually outsource the actual casting of the head and then we finish it. But
yeah,
hopefully stay tuned. 2022, you too can have a cleaver hawk that not only is the greatest cleaver I've ever used, but you can also, you know, throw it at trees awesome. Around the campfire when you're done.
That is awesome. Well, that's a hot news piece. I'm excited about it. I'd like to see it. Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Wow. That's cool. So let's shift back. So you got into, now we've talked chef knives, we've talked hunting knives, pocket knives.
You know, I could add something, you know, about our hunting knives that is kind of unique because we make kitchen knives, and I think it is what kind of makes our knives unique. You know, my whole time making knives, I'd go to the knife show with the other guys and I'd have kitchen knives, and they'd, you know, they kind of look down their nose at me, you know, oh, he's making the girl knives, you know, that kind of stuff. And the whole time I was always like, okay, guy, you know, like, even if you hunt all the time, your hunting knife, how often do you get it out?
Yeah.
Like, not so much. Whereas if you use a kitchen knife, you know, especially if you use a commercial kitchen knife, commercially use a kitchen knife, you're 8 hours a day or 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, forever and ever and ever. And you're also, you know, exposing the knife to a lot of water and acidic foods and, you know, just far more abuse than you really will put a hunting knife through, particularly in terms of reps and all that stuff. So, you know, when we got to making hunting knives, and actually, we have a great fillet knife too. While I'm plugging my stuff, you know, we brought 15 years of experience in trying to make a knife that you couldn't break, you couldn't destroy. And so, it really, I think, you know, they're pretty too. But like we are using the highest performance steel that you can buy, and it has to stand up to the rigors of the kitchen. And I'm super comfortable that it can handle anything that happens in the field after all of that time, you know, experience with trying to make.
I tell you, I'm you know, I haven't got my hands on a kitchen knife, on one of your kitchen knives yet, but it's on my Santa Claus list. So I've informed my wife of it. Maybe she'll surprise me when we're in Park City.
Okay.
But the you guys sent me the Hunter and the Outfitter, two of the knives that you've got, and like I said earlier, I took them with me to Wyoming when we went up on our pronghorn hunt, and I, you know, gutted and prepared the antelope in the field with it, and then I brought it home and I used it entirely to process it in the kitchen, and like from start to finish, like phenomenal. And out of, I thought it's awesome. You guys send those Band-Aids in the package of like, it's sharp. That absolutely, I chuckled at that when I opened the box and saw the Band-Aids. And I was like, this is great. But it's so true. That knife was so sharp. And I tell you, by the time I was in processing the antelope, it was still phenomenally sharp. Like, it was awesome. I'm so stoked about it.
Cool.
It's great to hear. I want to ask you though, and this is for a lot of people, and you know, we get a good mix. We get hunters, we get anglers, we get foragers, but a lot of our listeners are really, really focused in the kitchen, and we talk about sharp knives. I harp on it all the time as a, you know, a former professional chef myself. It's like, you got to have a good knife, you got to have a sharp knife. But to you as a knife maker, why should people have a good knife and why should people have a sharp knife?
Well, I mean, Yeah. The knife is the essential tool, right? Cast iron skillet and a knife and you're good to go. I think, you know, a quality knife and yeah, so you should have a good knife and a way to sharpen it really are the two things, right? And, you know, it just, for our knife, especially, you know, being that really high end aesthetic, all that stuff, like, you know, it just makes this task that we all have to do more of a pleasure. You know, like some tagline we had for a while was like, the cooking is a fine art and the knife is the artist's brush. Like you, with a sharp knife, you can do everything faster, right? You can actually, you know, envision what the food, how you want it to look when you cut it and actually do it. Whereas, you know, without a sharp knife, you end up smashing food or, you know, not being able to cut it in the way that you could.
And I tell people this too, is like more people cut themselves on dull knives than people cut themselves on sharp knives. And they're like, what do you mean? Yeah. I'm like, think about it. The amount of pressure you have to apply to a dull knife, and then you start you losing control of it and things like that. But when you have a really sharp knife, it's literally just like you touch it and it goes through. You touch it and it goes through, and it's smooth.
Yeah, that's, even the sharp ones will get you now and then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I got scars to prove it.
I have one spot that I, you know, as a chef, you know this, like most of the time on the cutting board when you're using a chef knife, you're guiding it with your other hand. Like to me, that is the essential skill of efficient cutting in the kitchen is not the hand that's holding the knife, but the other hand that's guiding. And I have this spot on my middle finger knuckle that I would say, how long? I was just getting married. So 20 years ago, I had this Chinese cleaver that was not that sharp. And I was pushing really hard on it. And I cut my entire knuckle. It was like a dime size slice of skin that had the wrinkles, you know, the knuckle wrinkles on it. And I think it protrudes just a slight bit. And I'd say once every year or two, I'll nick it. I literally just did it like 3 days ago. I'm looking at it right now. So even if you're skilled with a knife, you know, it's just the cost of doing business. Every now and then, I've never gotten stitches, but every now and then you'll pay with blood a little bit.
I think probably my worst one. So, my professional career started in New Orleans, and so I was opening a bag of crawfish tails in my station, and instead of walking over to the next station and picking up the pair of kitchen shears and cutting the bag open, I picked up the bag and I held it, you know, in my hand, much like I was going to show the person, like, hey, look at these crawfish tail. And I took my knife and I slid it in to the middle of the bag, and then I pushed it outward away from my body, which is the right thing to do if you're going to do that. But my middle finger was hanging down like this, and I caught my middle finger when on my pass, and my knife was sharp enough that it went in probably, I'd say, a quarter half inch into my finger and then into my nail and like cut into the nail. And I was like, oh, and then I pulled it up and looked at it, and not to be too graphic, but it spurted blood all over my white chef coat. And then the chef was like, all right, go to the bar and get some ice water. So then here I am, like, holding my finger, walking, you know, half the restaurant to go get ice water to stick my finger in. Luckily, I didn't need stitches, but, you get some bites sometimes.
It happens.
One program, which I think is really cool that you guys have gotten involved in, is the Slow Food and Sharp Knives program. And being as someone who has kids, I think that's a really neat, really neat program. Can you tell me a little more about it?
Well, we, you know, so our local Slow Food, like Slow Food of the Tetons is what it's called. We sponsor them every year. Is it still going on? I think it might be still going on. You could still get a raffle ticket where we do a raffle where we add knives, and then that's combined with food products that local producers have made. And then in the summer, they do a, and it goes to sponsor summertime cooking classes for kids. And they have it at a local farm, which is so great. And then we do, and I think it's a weekly class for one of those segments. Our Kim Kent, who is our, works at our store, but is also our CIA graduated culinary expert. So she goes down and teaches the kids how to use a kitchen knife with every one of those.
Which I think is such an important foundation when you're talking about kids learning to cook and kids being in the kitchen. And it's very daunting to think about, but it's a skill. Like, you're going to use a knife for the rest of your life, to whether you're cutting meat, you're cutting potatoes, or you're doing anything else. Like, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And why not, instead of, you know, at a responsible age, like, I'm not going to give my 18-month-year-old son, like, hey, here's this knife, let's go chop some carrots. But, you know, at a good responsible age, I think it's appropriate to start showing them and letting them kind of learn in a constructive manner on how to use knives.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what is, like, when I go to the, I'm sure you've had this experience, when you go to the grocery store and, like, particularly in the produce section, like, it's super big. It keeps getting to be more and more where they have the pre-cut mm-hmm. vegetables that are like gray.
Nope.
I'm like, no. I mean, it's just, you know, man has been using sharp implements since probably before we invented fire.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, folks. We can do this. I really think, you know, as New West Knifeworks grows, like, we're kind of getting to this place now where it's a thing and we can really, I mean, we have always, you know, we have, in every town we have a store, we have always donated knives to every silent auction for any fundraiser in town. So we're always into that stuff. But now we can really, like, project maybe our own directed kind of efforts from a nonprofit standpoint. And it's definitely about, you know, my two passions are, you know, local produce and cooking. So, you know, we're, in the years to come, like, we're gonna do the best we can to, like, help teach the world to cook, particularly cut their food, and then, you know, whatever we can do to support local food and produce.
That's awesome. That definitely shows your commitment beyond just creating awesome knives. Is like, hey, we're here for the people. Like, it's a good thing.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
I was reading this article too, and I realized it was your son on Chopped.
Yeah, I mean, as a father, I can just brag. I think officially, my son is the greatest child chef in America.
Yeah, it's showing he's a grand champion, right?
That's yeah, awesome. He was on an episode and won an episode, and then they had a tournament of champions, and he won that.
That's awesome. What did he cook?
Well, I mean, if you've seen it, there were, you know, there's like every episode, there's three rounds. It's like an appetizer, mm-hmm. a kind of main course entree, and then a dessert. His final dessert, which just warms the Midwestern heart, is he made this, what he called a deconstructed pie. You know, they have 20 okay. minutes. You can't make a pie in 20 minutes. So
no.
he made a crust and baked that off separately. And then kind of made a filling and put that on top and use the ingredients to make, I don't know, it was like Chantilly cream sauce, which I don't even know what that was, to make a whipped cream. But, you know, I was thinking about that today. I didn't know if we were going to talk about it. I think one of the biggest reasons why he was so successful was that, you know, Chopped, if you haven't seen it, the whole, you know, the gimmick on it is that for each thing, you get a basket with four random ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they tried, you know, one of his things was like ground camel, which is so wheelhouse, right? Because all we do is eat ground game meat.
Yeah.
So that's no problem.
But, yeah.
But, that's kind of how we roll at my house. Like, I'm so passionate about local produce that, like, we just cook whatever's available at a given time. So it's like either something that we caught, hunt, or foraged, or I garden, and it's, or, you know, whatever berry is in season or whatever it is, like, that it's basically how we cook every meal. It's like, here's the things that are available. And I'm kind of like, most of the time, kind of cuckoo about it. Like, I'm just like, nothing can come from anywhere else. And so, like, his whole cooking thing has always been, you know, here's the choices, make something.
Yeah.
And I feel like that did really help in that. And I can also think of another one what was it? He had one where they gave them some giant piece of pork, like a whole side or something. And we had literally like butchered a pig probably within the month.
That's awesome.
Whereas every other kid on there was like, what in the hell is this? And so it was like, it was almost like, wow, are we cheating here? Like, did they know? Anyway, proud parents, so I have to guess about them all day long.
No, that's awesome. I saw that. I was reading the article that that Corey linked in here to the Slow Foods and Sharp Knives, and I was like, holy smokes, what a cool thing. So it's really awesome. I imagine that you are definitely a proud parent, especially with your culinary background and your passion for food. So it shines very, very through, and that's a great thing. So
you know, I would just say it was funny. The first episode he was on, and he was super young. I guess he was probably 10.
Mm-hmm.
He and I have cooked together his whole life. But like, you know, there can only be one chef in the kitchen, and I am a tyrant. So like, before he got on the show, I don't think I'd ever let him cook a whole meal. Like, I'm like, he's just like my prep cook, sous chef, and he gets on the show, and I'm like, wow. How about you?
Yeah. You're like, all right, well, you got dinner next week, so.
Yeah.
So I want to talk definitely about your recipes and the two points we talked up. Let's talk a little bit about your conservation projects that you're involved in and have helped create a little bit. So what's I guess a lot centered around the Snake River, which is really awesome. I've learned now your passion for fishing and rafting and kayaking on the Snake River. So how did that play out? How did you step into the conservation world as well?
How did that happen? I mean, I guess I've always been kind of a, you know, socially conscious person in terms of wanting to give back and do stuff. And the Snake River, you know, I said, I was a raft guy for many years, and that really, like, my early days in Jackson Hole, like, I was on the water all summer, and still my passion. My kids are unbelievable kayakers now, and it was not my initial idea. Was this idea, or actually, you know, I had talked about it probably a decade before with some friends that, oh, we should get the Snake River designated wild and scenic. And, you know, we were super young then. We didn't know anything about what we were talking about. And then,
so what does that wild and scenic designation indicate?
So it's, you know, it's a federal designation that's passed by Congress that there's actually different levels of it. It's been a while here. I'm going to stumble over some of the details of this, but there's wild, scenic, and recreational designation. Each one has different levels of protection.
Okay.
Depending on the criteria. And I, you know, a group had formed and I end up getting on the board and I, you know, I helped do some stuff along the path. And in the end, we ended up getting the largest wild and scenic designation in the history of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So it was all the sections of the snake that were applicable and then a ton of the tributaries. And all different sections got different designations, whether it was wild, scenic, or recreational. And so at the end of the day, it, you know, it originally came out as its primary thing was to make sure the dams couldn't be built.
Okay.
But then it offers other protections in terms of, you know, activities around the water that could potentially cause damage to the ecosystem. So, I mean, that was a while ago. I guess that was probably 15 years ago, but, you know, it was a cool thing. It was something to be proud of, for sure. I'm really excited. I'm happy to have been a part of it. But so I certainly was not the only person involved.
Yeah, hey, you were involved nonetheless. Like, that's something, like you said, to be very proud of. I think it's a cool thing. And let's see, I was just looking on the map because I was trying to see exactly where. So the Snake River, it flows from Wyoming through Idaho into Washington?
Yeah, that's right. And so we're the headwaters. That's why it was like such a cool deal. Like, there was, at the time, there was somebody had done a national study of like the water quality throughout the United States, and the Snake River headwaters was like the cleanest of the clean throughout the United States. And that's because it drains Yellowstone, you know, Southern Yellowstone, and through Grand Teton National Park. So there's so little development up that way that it's just this super clean water system. So that was like kind of the driver. It was like, it's so pristine now. Let's see if we can keep it that way.
Oh, that's awesome. Sweet. Well, I mean, I thank you as someone who loves the outdoors, who loves hunting, who loves fishing. Like, I thank you for your involvement in that, because that's a cool thing that now people for many generations can enjoy. So,
yeah, that's sweet.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some recipes. So I like to ask. I'll say this on behalf of Corey, my co-host, who's unfortunately a little under the weather tonight, so he's not here. But what game or fish do you have in your freezer now?
Let's see. What do I have? I think, you know, I haven't. I just a year ago we just got a little Milligan family homestead in Victor, Idaho, over Teton Pass from Jackson Hole.
Okay.
And I have been fulfilling my lifelong dream of being a homesteader.
Oh, sweet.
So the last year I've been super focused not on what I can hunt, but what I can raise and grow.
Okay.
So right now I think the only wild game I have in there, I'm sure there's something buried in the bottom, but is the remains of the whitetail slaughter from last year's trip.
Sure.
But along with that, it is, and I really couldn't hunt because the food is falling out, and I still have another pig and 12 chickens to butcher.
Oh, but, wow.
There's a lot of pig. I had a sweet knife trade with an Alaskan fisherman, so there's a ton of salmon in there. Now that I think about it, a buddy gave me some moose, so there's some moose in there. Yeah, I think that's most of the larder. But if the apocalypse, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience, and a lot of your listeners, like, COVID really sent the old, you know, sent the let's make sure we have enough food on hand thing to a whole nother level.
Oh, 100%.
So I feel like if the apocalypse hits, mama will still be like, you know, 2-3 Michelin stars probably can make it till spring, and then it's, you know, then there's no stopping us.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, so you mentioned to me earlier before that you had a great story about eating beaver meat. So I'm curious now. You've got me, we've been sitting here talking for now like 50 minutes and I'm like, all right, I got to hear this beaver story.
Yeah. So, you know, I own a mountain man shop. So, you know, we literally have, trappers come in and we do some, you know, trading. But I also have a buddy who is a trapper in Jackson. And what got me into it was I was reading Undaunted Courage, you know, the story of Lewis and yep. Clark. And they mentioned that on, I think it was Meriwether Lewis's, I want to say it was, on his birthday, he ate beaver tail. It was his favorite thing. And, you know, they ate everything that walked, flew, and swam in the Rocky Mountain West. And he had requested beaver tail. So I was like, oh, what is this? So I asked my buddy, who's the trapper, to if I could have some beaver meat. And he, you know, in Jackson Hole, you're a beaver trapper, not because there's a great business in pelts. It's because some billionaire has a beaver that's eating $10,000 worth of landscaping. So that's why they were trapping beavers. And so, and you know, they basically threw away the meat. And or he would freeze it, you know, and it would probably languish in his freezer until they threw it away. But so I got it, and I quickly, you know, I looked at that flap, the tail, I cut into it. I was like, how could this be the thing? And then as we butchered it, and there's no, you know, Undaunted Courage does not give the butchering instructions or what he actually mm-hmm. ate. But what I found is between the flap and the pelvis is like an extension of the loin. And, you know, it's the muscle that drives the tail, the flap. And I really kind of decided that I think that was what he was, is the delicacy. And it's funny, we happened to be butchering a pig when he brought that over, and I did make this lovely, you know, I think I put a couple sage leaves in and wrapped it in caul fat from the pig and seared that up. And I happen to have a super fancy wine from Napa where we have a store, and there's this just classic picture of butcher paper with, like, you know, there's blood on one half. And we have this beautiful plate with the caul fat seared beaver tail and this super big Napa cab. And it was awesome. Ooh. Really good. That was good. And then I also braised mm-hmm. the rest of it in red wine. And in the end, I've eaten it a few times since then. It tasted like more beef than
really
beef. Like this super dense, like red meaty taste. And I actually think a big part of it is, you know, these beavers are trapped, so they're not bled. So I think there was probably, that's a factor of it, that it's kind of like blood rich in it. But it was like the beefiest beef taste that I can think of.
It's interesting. We have a video on our website. It's a beaver bomber sandwiches, and it's like this. I think it's a combination of like braised and smoked, maybe like beaver quarters, but it's then like pooled. Oh my gosh, with like red peppers and grilled onions, and oh man, it looks phenomenal. But I have yet to have beaver. It's on my list. I'm holding a fur bear tag for Colorado, and I'm waiting for the snow. So, but man, that, yes. I'm
now, or would you trap that thing?
I would try to hunt it. I would try to hunt it. Shoot I think.
It. Yeah. I think it'd be even better then.
Yeah.
Then you can eat it.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to go out. Cause when I was up elk hunting up in the mountains, I saw a lot of places, and actually even we were down, on the Platte, doing a little small game hunting in between mule deer. And, I found some beaver dams, and I was like, huh, I'm gonna have to come back here and see what I can poke around.
Oh,
but
cool.
I'm really curious now that you mentioned that sort of like extension of the loin on the tail, cause that's going to be something that's really protected by the tail, and man, that's gotta be so tender. Huh?
Yeah.
You got my wheels spinning.
Yeah.
You got my wheels spinning, which is good.
There you go. I mean, I don't think there's going to be enough time, but you'll have to have me back for me to tell you the tales of the beaver butt sauce.
The what?
You know, beaver has a scent gland that's called castoreum.
Yep.
And I got sensitized to it because I saw something on social media that was like, they're putting beaver butt sauce in our food, you know, with some sort of thing. And like, castoreum is an FDA-approved food additive.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, oh, what's this? you know, anytime there's like, ooh, there's something I haven't eaten that I could eat. but that, you know, I mean, we could go a whole segment. I'll just say it's like nothing you've ever experienced.
Really? Yeah. You're definitely going to have to come back on it. We're going to have to talk about that. It's a good cliffhanger.
I just love, I mean, the stories I could tell them. Yep. Sorry for the tease.
No. It's good. It keeps us all hungry, including me, for like more. But you also mentioned 13 animal chili.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I play rugby with the Jacksonville Moose.
You play rugby too? I play rugby.
No way.
Yeah.
We're like brothers from another mother.
Right? Oh, man. We're going to have to talk about rugby after the show, but for sure.
Yeah, that sounds good. I just played in my I'm 51. I played 4 games this year. It's hard to believe.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
But so we were going to this legendary rugby tournament, Missoula Maggot Fest.
Okay.
You know, we could do a podcast on that, too. But in going, I've been kind of the F&B chair for the rugby club for 30 years, and you know, it's one of my great places to experiment on in cuisine because they'll eat anything.
Yep.
And so on the way to the game, I was like, all right, boys, I want to make chili for the trip. Empty your freezers. And so I made a chili that had 13 animals in it. I had to write it down before the podcast here to try to remember what they were. And, you know, some of these, remember, we have a trapper on the team. So there was moose, elk, mule deer, whitetail, pronghorn, grouse, bison, cow, pig, muskrat, beaver, duck, and goose in it.
Holy smokes, what a chili. Now, so
you know what it tasted like?
What did it taste like? Chilies?
Chili.
So let me ask you this. We had a whole like chili episode where we got deep in the weeds talking about chili. But are you a beans in your chili guy or a no beans in your chili guy?
I think in my later life I have added the bean.
You have?
Yeah, I've added the bean. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, which is one of the chili capitals of the United States, and mm-hmm. it's not a bean chili to start. But as I've evolved as a you know, where my health has started to come into concern or a consideration, adding the fiber to the beans. So yes, these days I do add the beans.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm a beans guy, and it's like every time I say that the shrill, I can hear through the headphones of the listeners in Texas just like shaking because we're adding beans in our chili, but that's okay.
I feel like, you know, I'd say I've been making chili the second longest thing of anything in my life. And it's amazing. I feel like I continue to evolve as I learn other things about cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, the chili I make, like, I think it's superfood. Like, if I think you could live on it.
Yep.
And be super helpful. Like, I put a ton of, you know, tomato, onion, carrot, celery in there, and so by the time it's done, I think it's probably, and if you add beans, like it's probably at least 50-75% vegetable and 25% meat, which is probably the perfect diet, I think.
And it's really like, it's very nutrition dense too. Like, it's not, you know, a lot of chilies aren't super watery. You get like a good thick chili, so when you're getting a spoonful, like, you're getting a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny, I've just you know, the freezer is, I've got a jam of chickens and pigs in there. There's like, there's a couple shelves of last year's remnants that are all going into a batch of chili for my, for the boys and girls at the knife factory.
Awesome.
Next week. Clean out the freezer and make them chili.
So let me ask you, since you're from up Ohio, Cincinnati chili or Skyline chili, is that do you still get behind those?
Yeah, Skyline for sure. I get it when I go home to visit. I get Skyline chili and Donato's pizza.
I did a recipe for Meat Eater, and I did a Cincinnati chili, and like, people were very. I was reading the comments on Facebook, and people were like very concerned and like confused. I was like, it's okay, guys. Yeah. It's okay. Like, it's good. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. I don't make chili that tastes like that, but it's definitely a cool, unique taste. Mm-hmm. If you haven't had it, it's it's a cool thing.
Absolutely. So, well, I think we're unfortunately starting to tick down on our time. So, what's a good way for people to connect with either you or with the knife company? Like, what's the best way?
I would say, you know, website.
Sure.
NewWestKnifeWorks.com. And then there's links to everything in the world.
Sure.
There.
And you guys are on Instagram as well, at NWKnifeWorks, I think is your handle.
Yeah. That's not my main zone of influence.
No.
I'll go with what you said.
No, it's fair. We get a lot of our listeners very heavily involved in Instagram, so all good. I always like to throw that out there. But
I'm learning quickly that, you know, I mean, it should seem obvious for a business of our size, but like, we're not doing enough in terms of the business of the internet when it comes to Instagram. You'll see more of us soon. We're getting it figured
out. That's awesome. Yeah. I have some pictures to send you guys if I haven't already. So, happy to share anything we have. So, awesome. I will say this. So this is kind of the point in our show where we give, everyone the opportunity to, give a misfire, alibi, last note, anything you want to leave the listeners with. I give you the floor.
Well, I think I said this to you, off air is, you know, I hadn't listened to a ton of episodes, and when I was driving here, I listened to a couple today, and I really congratulate you. Like,
thank you.
Fantastic content. I'm honored to be on this show with the people that I heard talk today, and it's just so awesome how many of us are that really are into this thing of food and hunting and gathering and all that stuff, and it's come so far in the 20 years I've been sensitized to it, and it's so awesome. And then I would also add, Christmas comes but once a year.
Yes.
And our knives are made in America. They're not stuck in a container ship in China. So feel free to get something for your loved ones. They will appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. If they're holding the same knives I held this past week, like they'll love it. So absolutely. Well, thank you for coming on, Corey. I really appreciate it. It was absolutely great conversation. We're gonna have to come back and revisit some of these topics at a later time, but I'm excited to discuss those as well. But for everybody out there that's listening, make sure you go over to visit New West Knife Works website and you know, check them out on Instagram as well. Give them a follow, and then you know, as always, the links to the things we've mentioned will be in the show notes. If you scroll down on whatever podcast platform you're on, you'll see those links there, so you can visit the website. You can hear about or read about slow food and sharp knives, and look at some of the things going on in the Mountain Man toy shop as well. And then, as always, once you're done browsing all that, make sure you're following Harvest in Nature on social media. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, please punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, and, you know, tell us what we're doing wrong or tell us what we're doing right. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
I'm Will Cooper, and you're listening to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast on the Waypoint Podcast Network. Stick around as I bring you more stories and interviews from veteran hunters and industry professionals who inspire us all to be better equipped in the woods and in life. I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.